Hello, this is Everett Wexler. Welcome to Vintage Annals Archive Outsider Podcast. I'm hugely excited to present our guest for the second time in the last year and a half, which is Paul Williams. I got very lucky to have gotten to know Paul. He's been very generous to our page. I think for the first time interviewing anybody because of Paul's generosity, I realized I didn't totally suck at this. And whatever, he was so giving to me that I kind of, whatever was kind of, took me a long time to get used to doing this stuff and to become at all good at it, that started with Paul. One thing I want to really put out there is to get to a point of having someone like Paul involved with the work we're doing is a lot of work and none of it's paid. I'm probably down around $8,000 or $10,000, which is okay. Getting to do this is the best. But if you do want to help, we've got different ways you can help. If you go to our vintageannalsarchive.com page, there is a donation support page you can go to. I am on Cash App at $RichWexler, RichWexler, Venmo.com/Rich-Wexler. PayPal is new, NEWCASTRO, camera, CAMERA, photography, PHOTOGRAPHY at gmail.com. And we need all kinds of help. If you do any kind of nonprofit work and like to get involved with us, we really need some help. I definitely can pay you, but we definitely need some help as well. Anyway, without further ado, I was really lucky to get such a great team of co-hosts, which is Tilly Lambs, Suki Jones, Perry Schall, and Stephen Bloom, all picked for their expertise in some area. I don't want to say much more, but thank you. Please spread the word on this. There's something very special that happened this night. Very raw, very, you'll hear it, but something very special. And I want to continue this kind of work. And I'm hoping if you listen to this, you'll understand the kind of work we're doing and where it's going and how authentic and real it is. And how proud I am to do it, and I want to keep doing it. I definitely can't keep doing this if I'm losing $3,000-$4,000 a year. We give out grants, we pay around $2,000 a year to different artists to help them make their work, to stay independent. Anyway, thank you. Please follow us on Vintage Annals Archive on Instagram. Follow our Arlene Godfrey Legacy Project. Please follow our Jewish Vintage Annals Archive. And please consider giving, and we are working on becoming a nonprofit, which will be easier to give. But anything you can do to help us, spreading the word, we need all the kind of help we can get. Thank you, and enjoy this episode. There is something, again, very special about this, and some of it's deep, so trigger warning. Some of it is very deep. We talk about recovery. We talk about some serious things, so keep that in mind when you're listening. I wanted to just talk about Paul for a minute and why I'm very lucky to know him. Basically, I was 9 years old. My mother took me to a Muppet movie. The words at the end of the Muppet movie changed my life. I was going to do the very end of it instead of all of it, but it's a whole piece. But there's a part at the end of the movie. I'm 9 years old. Life's like a movie. Write your own ending. Keep believing. Keep pretending. We've done just what we set out to do. Thanks to the lovers, your dreamers, and you. And there's a point in that where Kermit, like, it's almost like he breaks the fourth wall and talks to the audience. I'm not sure if any of you saw that when you were young or whatever. And I can tell you in that moment, it changed my life forever. And to get to meet the person, and, you know, and also, I mean, oh, I got to put my lights on. Last time we did this, Paul couldn't see me, and I wanted you to see the posters behind my head. And, you know, with my love for Jim Henson and all things Muppets, Paul was graciously enough after, I think I chased you down for a while, Paul, right? I think I chased you down for a long time to get you to because I know you're very busy, not because you were avoiding, but you're a very busy person.
Once I checked out, you know, the your Instagram account, I was hooked. So from then on, it was brothers.
And I just want to say, in terms of when I got to interview Paul, I don't know what happened, but he made me so comfortable that it was the first time I actually believed I could do this. And there was a few moments in doing this. Again, I was doing this like for the first 7 or 8 months, I did this without a job. And I was just trying to see what I could do with it. And whenever it got really hard, I would just get a really nice message from Paul. And I feel like he really helped me out. And the last thing I'll say is in the interview, you know, he told me everyone is a teacher to me. Everyone I've ever got to interview was to me, gave me a lesson. The two lessons I got from Paul, one were the, I guess, I don't know if it, the joy of no, the, how someone saying no to you could be a gift of no. And then the other piece was just like, I mean, after that conversation, I believed in magic in a real way. So I just want to introduce, I'm just happy, you know, I'm really happy everyone's here. I'm going to just ask, set up a few rules. We'll keep it pretty chill. I think we can just have a really good time together. I just want, the way we're going to do it is we're kind of sectioning it off. We're going to start with Phantom of the Paradise because Perry, I talked to Perry about a year ago and I was like, if I ever get to talk to Paul again, you're going to be on. And I didn't know I could do it and I'm happy it's here. And Perry, Perry is, show your tattoo, Perry.
Which one? Oh, yeah.
Which one?
Oh my god, I love tats. Look at this. Oh my god.
So Perry, you know, one thing I usually do with interviews, if there's somebody who knows more about something, I bring them on as a ringer, and then I'm like, wait, why am I even talking if they know more? So Perry is here to talk about Phantom. We're going to start there. I'm going to introduce everybody once we do their section. We're going to talk a little bit about 20 minutes or half hour for Phantom. It's 50th anniversary. We're going to get into, I really love the documentary, Paul Weeb's Still Alive. If you haven't seen it, watch it. And I think what I learned about it was, I love the ending, Paul, and I think you're talking and you're saying, you're explaining that the moments with your family, moments doing what you love now, seemed more important than your career. That it seemed like you helping people, you being in recovery, you having time with your family and having a normal life was so much bigger than any big thing that happened in your career. Did I misread that? Or do you feel like, you know, that is...
Let me just jump in and respond to that, because I have to tell you that was accurate at the time. I think what has happened since is that my life has become a total hybrid, because, you know, in recovery, I have a home group that meets, you know, on Zoom and it is a collage of people that I trust and love and that I learn from and like that. Now I'm sitting here and I'm looking at a collage of people that some of whom I know, but have a sense of being amongst family already. So this the way that my life has unfolded, I realize that I don't have fans. I have friends, and most of them are as obsessed as I am when you really love something. And what I get about out of this, Rich, is a chance to say to the people that have been obsessed with something like Phantom of the Paradise, you're the reason for most of the things that are good in my career, in my life right now. Because the people that I'm working for, you know, when I get cast in a movie like Baby Driver, it's because the director of that film loved Phantom of the Paradise and Bugsy Malone. And it's those of you who were just obsessed and kept telling people, you got to watch this, you got to watch this, you got to watch this. And some of them said, well, you're fucking nuts. And some of them said, you're right. And so you're a participant. So that sense of sitting down with fans is just, I mean, it just doesn't work for me anymore. I just, you know, I'm just really grateful and all. And there are people on here that are just, you know, there are a couple that are absolute brothers. You know, my brother John Tita is there, who probably is the songwriter's best friend in the world. And somebody that I work with at ASCAP that is just, I mean, I could do this next hour on John Tita. So enjoy the company and look around and realize that, include yourself in the phrase of gathering of eagles, because you are.
And there are a lot of musicians here. There are a lot of artists. There are a lot, a few puppeteers.
The one commercial I'm going to do is, wait a minute. It's Susie. This is, you know, my wife and I are trying to read this at the same time. I have to keep taking it back. You know, if you haven't read this, you got to read it.
I can't see everybody. Is there a way to see everybody at once, or not so much?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, I can't, but it's okay. All right.
Double screens here.
So Paul, I'll let you, is there anything else you want to just start off with, you want to just share with the group, and then we'll get into Phantom. That's okay.
The reason for doing this is because I made a friend named Rich, and that we care about some of the same things, and it's a time when, when culture is the one thing that feels like kind of a constant right now in our world and everything, and the way culture is being treated, sometimes with great respect, as in this gathering, and sometimes with, by the people that use our music in the world of streaming, not so much, So what I think is the reason for me doing this is a way to say thank you, and also I really believe that from these ideas, from us sitting here and having a moment and talking about something, one of you is liable to do something that is going to make something a little better or maybe a lot better. Life's like a movie, write your own ending, keep believing. Keep pretending. We've done just what we set out to do. Not I've. We've done just what we set out to do. And the potential for this gathering and this kind of thinking and these hearts like yours and mine, I think are incredibly powerful. And I also believe that what we dwell on, we create. And I think that to maintain that positive thinking about being able to do good in this world and see it turn into a better place is important. And I'm going to shut up and let you guys
I just
talk.
want to say about Paul is I don't think I've met somebody who is this funny, generous, kindness. Like I learned levels of generosity that I never understood before from Paul. All right,
Thank
we are
you.
going to get into Phantom. So that goes to you, Perry. So the way we're going to do this, because we have a little more time and because we're going to be a little more open, I will be able to probably, if we keep questions to like 1 or 2 minutes, if we can do that, I could probably bring some of you in, hopefully more of you in in sections. So I'm going to ask you to let the host kind of do their thing. And then, you could lead that, Perry, if you want to bring people in. And I'm thinking just maybe three, we still got to, I'm going to stop talking now, but I want to keep it simple, but I want to give everyone room. But to do that, we got to have people kind of come in and be quick about it, if that's okay with everybody. And then we're going to section it off and we'll have some time at the end. We'll leave for Q&A. So Perry, it's on you, man. Perry, I've known for a long time. We hail from the same neighborhood, although I'm like, probably could be a young father to you since we're about 15 years apart. Perry's one of my favorite people. We share a lot of same interests. And again, we also share a love for Paul. I think both of us had interacted with you, Paul, over the years, and it was always nice. And we're like, oh my God, Paul said hello to me. It was nice. Like, to me, you responding to fans is the reason that you have so many great people around you. So when I was going to talk to you again, I was like, I got to bring Perry in because he knows Phantom more. He's probably seen Phantom. How many times have you seen Phantom?
I don't know. I'll, many, many, many times.
About more than
I
20?
wouldn't even know. Yeah, more than 20. Yeah.
All right. All
I
right.
used to, well, maybe this is a good intro, but I used to have a birthday party every year where I invited people who hadn't seen the movie yet to just so they had to watch it with me. As it's like a trick into getting them to celebrate with me really was, hey, I just wanted to show you this movie. It's not so much about the birthday, but I got so many people obsessed with this movie the way that I had been for so long. So
I rest my case. You just proved me right.
yeah. It was also Perry's first date at all times. Sorry, you're back to you. My apology.
I guess just to intro a little bit, the way that I discovered Phantom, also I had known Paul's music and who he was, would recognize him on TV kind of thing, but until Phantom, I didn't really know enough. And then I became completely obsessed with Paul Williams. And as a kid, we had like an illegal cable box where we got random channels. I don't even know how it happened, but there would be this thing that would happen where I would stay up late at night watching TV and this movie would come on and it would be in different parts of the movie each time. I'd catch a little bit of it. I had no idea what it was, and I was completely obsessed with it. And every few months, I'd catch another part of it until one day I got to see the entire thing all the way through. And it blew my mind. Like every time even if I saw a minute of it, it was mind blowing to me as a kid. And I made sure after that, I would look, I had to look it up in the TV guide to see what it was at the time. And it would cut off part of the title. So sometimes I wouldn't even know what movie it was. And eventually when I found out, I couldn't believe this wasn't like everybody hasn't seen this movie. And so now it's like been my goal to make sure that everybody sees this movie who hasn't. Sorry to go on about that. So when, how was this movie first brought to you? Like, was it from Brian De Palma directly?
Well, you know, I was a blue collar songwriter, you know, a songwriter at A&M Records, and they had hired somebody to try to get A&M's artists basically more involved in film. So they hired a gentleman, and one of the first projects that came across his desk was Phantom of the Paradise, originally called Phantom of the Fillmore. In discussing this with Brian De Palma, and I assume that there was somebody in between the conversation with, you know, the first person that showed up at the lot and Brian, I assume there was a music supervisor or somebody involved that I know that by the time it got to me, I had a script in my hand, and I read it, and I met with Brian, and it was interesting because I don't think there was a person based on what I'd done that was more inappropriate to write the songs for Phantom of the Paradise. I mean, my success was at that point was Three Dog Night, and with no disrespect to Three Dog Night and as a rock and roll group, but the songs of mine that they recorded were pretty soft. I had most of my success was kind of middle of the road, you know, and I felt like I was rock and roll, black leather, white light, and all that. But the fact is, I was right for Steve Lawrence, who I loved.
Well, how about the Holy Mackerel? Like, what was that project?
That was my very, very first group. And it was just a little bit before this whole thing with Phantom. And the group was a small group of us, including my brother, who's a songwriter, was a songwriter. We recorded an album for Reprise. And by the time the album came out, the group had already dissolved. I mean, it was sort of put together for the album and then like bass players replaced in the middle of it and all. But Reprise kept me on and all. But the album is, if you know, it's interesting. The songs are very kind of, I'm trying to be Laurel Canyon.
I love it. I think it's like a really special record.
Oh, I appreciate that. But at any rate, what happened with Brian, based on the things that could be heard that I had written, it was interesting. I think what happened is I fell into that whole thing of how much I loved the idea that I was going to get to first of all, write these amazing stories that were all put together from the Phantom of the Opera, to right down the line, all of these major, major myths, you know, like in heroes' journeys and the like. But what I loved was the chance to satirize the different kinds of music. And I, you know, somebody who listened to a lot of music and loved it, and I had a road band, incidentally. My road band that I was playing with all the times. I mean, I used to joke that we were all so close that one of us could fart and the rest would feel better. I mean, it was a great band. And they were really, they were much better than what I felt like I deserved as a singer. I feel that now. I didn't feel it so much then. But we were so tight that when we hit each of these songs, you know, like Goodbye, Eddie, Goodbye and whatever, they just got it. They got where we were going. When we jumped into the upholstery, you know, and the singers were guys that I knew from a variety of other things that I'd been involved with, you know. So it was interesting because I was the wrong guy in the right place. And it worked out really beautifully for me. And Brian, watching the way that I helped, you know, carried myself in the studio, he got this kind of a, you know, I mean, when I get enthused, I get there's an energy. And he saw that, and he said, you know, there's this little kind of a kind of a Reader's Digest mini version of Phil Spector that I'm observing here. And he said, I wonder if you could play the Phantom. And I went, oh, God, no. I mean, I still say, oh, God, no. And, you know, I am not the actor that Bill Finley was. You know, Bill Finley with one eye and a mask could deliver a performance that would break your heart. I am not that guy. But when he asked me if I felt like I could handle Swan, I went, oh, yes. Oh, I would love what to play the devil, essentially, was just like, let man be Swan. Of course, you know, it was immediate, and it was a great collaborative experience, and that's how I got the job. End of speech.
Yeah. When you were reading the script, was there a specific thing that jumped out at you right away that made you want to do it, or were you questioning it at all at any point, or were you just like right from the beginning, this is incredible?
Well, as I read it, there were things that were, you know, I mean, it was all wonderful, but there were things that I wanted to change immediately. And I think Brian did too. One of the things he had thought about, you know, having Sean and I come in and play, you know, all the groups. And I thought they had a really solid brand and they were great. And I knew the guys, you know, but I wanted, if we were going to really make this, you know, music that was believably a believable adaptation of a certain style of music each time, I wanted guys that I could control and that would bring more to it than I did. I felt even, and they did, you know. So, but there were, like, the original opening was in a dentist chair where Annette is getting some dental work, and somebody comes in and cuts out her tongue and pulls it out, but it was like a 3-page scene, and it was, oh my God, you know. There has to be a, you know, so we did not stick with that scene. That evolved out of it. There were lots of changes. I think the major change in the whole concept of the film was when we got to the point where we realized that we were in this weird place in time where you couldn't really separate entertainment and the news. I mean, we were sitting at home eating, you know, with our TV trays, eating our TV dinners, watching the latest footage from Vietnam, and it was that day's footage, and it was graphic, and it was horrifying, and it was fascinating, I think that the idea of an audience that gets to the point where they cannot separate entertainment, you know, and reality, and became the center of that was when we hit the point of, okay, let's not, originally Beef was going to die in the shower, but when the decision was made to not have Beef die in the shower, but have Beef die on stage, and the kids think it's part of the show. What is, to me, the heart of the movie, which is expressed in the one line that is my favorite line in the movie, which is when Philbin asked me why an assassination, you know, like on television, and I say an assassination live on coast to coast television, that's entertainment. That to me is the heart of the message of the movie, and the change that came in little bits and pieces here and there. And brilliant direction from Brian. I mean,
fellow Philadelphian,
huh?
He's from Philadelphia.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Of course, he's great.
There was a moment in the picture when we were shooting up in Dallas at the Majestic Theater, and we would shoot stuff on stage, and then we go up and shoot myself and Herb Pacheco, who played my bodyguard, and up in the balcony, and then we'd go back and forth, and I come in, and I'm this wannabe, this, you know, mouthy little wannabe director, and I'm down there with Brian, and I said, Brian, you know what, anybody, you know, like a student of cinema would realize that you could put a Chapman Crane on this stage and go up and shoot up in the balcony and then back on the stage and back and forth without having to you know, to relight and move it like that, and without even looking away from his little eyepiece, he said the stage won't support the weight of a Chapman Crane. I was like, Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I figured, and well, I'll be in my dressing room. Just shut up, Paul, and do what you brought we're brought in to do.
Sorry, this is still I'm a little anxious. There's so much I want to know. Do you have any thoughts about, like, Rod Serling does the intro, right? The narration in the beginning of the movie. And there's so many, like, unique voices, like, talk, whether it's talking or singing in the entire movie. And I know there's, like, the different genres and playing all that out, but everybody's voice really stands out, like, unique for the movie, but also unique in general. Like, were you thinking about that stuff when you're writing the songs?
No, I don't think. I think I was trying to get the lyrics done. It was,
Were you fitting it to the movie specifically, or?
what was interesting is we were shooting during the day, and I was recording vocals at night with Jeffrey, and I was songwriter buddies at A&M with Jeffrey Commodore, and I thought, Jeffrey, you're perfect for one of the juicy fruits that evolve into all these other groups. And it was just natural nasal casting for him to sing Upholstery, where my baby lives up close to. I think we
It's
nailed the
incredible.
sound of the Beach Boys and all, and as he did as well. And there was casting in that sense. The one moment as far as finding the voice for the character, that is, it's interesting because it's actually in the film when Jessica Harper has actually talked about this. She was flown to New York from LA to, I think, to, or yeah was or was it the other way around? I honestly don't remember, but she was auditioning for Brian and I, and Brian liked her as an actress and wanted me to hear her sing. And I went into the audition, and in the waiting room outside, she was singing to herself. And for the audition, I had her sing, "Loneliness is such a sad affair." I can't remember the name of the song. Stars. So at any rate, she sang this beautifully, "Don't you remember you told me you love me, baby?" Just to herself, and it was stunning. And I'm standing next to her and listening, and it's just, it's it was it was you know it grabbed me by the heart, and immediately go
Superstar.
inside with Brian. I go inside with Brian, and she comes in and she sings "Long Ago" and sings out, and it's like a totally different. I went, wait. Sing it to yourself like you were doing out there. And she goes, "Long ago, and oh so far away, I fell in love with you there for the second show." And it was, oh my God. I mean, I just, it was something. And I think that that's where Brian got the idea, for that particular scene with Winslow coming up, beside her. I was blessed with such amazing actors and singers, that really brought the songs to life. Just amazing.
I was going to ask, like, Garrett Graham, does he not do, was it Ray Kennedy does the voice for Beef? Is that right? In, like, the singing parts? I feel like you're.
I was a big fan of Ray's, and it was actually done before we cast Garrett Graham as or before not we cast before Brian cast Garrett Graham, and Garrett was just stunning. To my horror, in some ways, when we shot the shower scene, when he's singing to himself, I go, "Oh my God, he could have done this beautifully," because he
That's,
sang
yeah.
great, And I think that it probably had a mild effect on our relationship through the years. But I mean, if there are two times in my life when I had voices replaced that I re regret, one was Jodie Foster and Bugsy Malone singing Tallulah, and I replaced the voice because all the voices were had this kind of a cartoonish thing we did that I did out of necessity, and the other one is Garrett's voice, and but Ray did an amazing job. It's a great vocal, and incidentally, when we shot that scene, Ray was I mean Garrett was so sick. He had like 103 fever. He could barely walk and talk, and then he gets in front of the camera and he just nails it, as you saw several times.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have this shirt. This is an original Phantom of the Paradise shirt.
Wow.
I don't know how many of these were even made. It was like for promotional, you know, maybe for the soundtrack more than even the movie or something. Maybe from the record label. I don't know. But I was wearing this. I should press it. Okay. I was friends with Gilbert Gottfried, who I know you were friends with him and you're on his podcast and stuff. And I was wearing this shirt in front of him once and he started immediately singing the hell of it. And then we both started singing this song from Phantom of the Paradise together with his amazing impression he did of you.
I have to point out that Frank is with us right now. Frank,
oh, he is.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
There you go.
Yes. Hey, Frank.
Hey, thank you all. Thanks for the shout out, Paul. I think Superstar was the song you were trying to think
Superstar,
of.
Superstar. See us. That's what we're
Leon Russell.
If anybody would know,
Leon Russell. Amazing. Exactly. Wow.
Good to see you, buddy. Thanks for the shout out.
You as well. And Gigi and you have been, you know, just an amazingly effective and emotionally attached part of my life. And it's a great surprise to see you here, Frank.
That's very touching. Thank you. It's a treat. And thanks to everybody for the invite. Thanks to Rich and to Gene for the invite.
Yeah, I had to give credit to Gene. Who has his own Muppet connection, but maybe we'll save that for another time, for connecting me with Frank. And it's really nice to meet you, Frank. Gene is Billy Beretta's brother, and Gene has been connected to the Muppets since he was. I interviewed Gene, and Gene was sharing a story about working with Brian Henson at the Sesame Place, and how when Jim came in, Jim like didn't ask for any special treatment, and it just seemed like it was nice to hear these stories about how down home Brian and Jim were. Do you have anything to reflect on just Jim while we're on the subject, Paul? It's hard to not bring some Muppets into this. Any reflection on just, you know, your relationship with Jim that you can, any stories, any quick reflection you can think about?
Just an amazing man to work for. I went over to do the Muppet movie, or the Muppet show rather, the first season. And it was, you know, I never belonged to a gang that had a treehouse. I always wanted to, you know, like, it's like there's a part of me that simply won't grow up. And I think I manifest that in my height. But there's this part of me that is just always kind of wanted to have this, kind of have that, you know, hang up. But that's part of what, you know, Tita is part of that world for me, because I feel like, you know, we have that kind of treehouse relationship and all. But so I walk on the set of the Muppets in England, and I was already a fan. I mean, I remember, before I knew they were called Muppets, I loved them when they were Slinkies and on, the Ed Sullivan Show and all. So. But also on the road with my band, I mean, we learned which fork to use watching Sesame Street. I mean, Bert and Ernie were like these little felt dudes were like our uncles that taught us how to behave, you know. So I walk on the set, and my relationship with all the Muppet performers was immediate. I mean, it was just all of a sudden the best sandbox I ever worked or played in. And I never saw the Muppets as an extension of their performers. If I was talking to Frank Oz, you know, and Jim, and they had Kermit and Miss Piggy, you know, with them, there were five of us in the conversation. You know, there would be, you know, the wisdom of Kermit, you know, and this, the rank, amazing insults and hilarity of the things that Piggy would say to me. Who's the little shit? You know, I mean, it's just, it was great, you know. And the wonderful thing that happened there is that Jim asked me if I'd write the songs for a project he was working on called Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas. And it was the beginning of that relationship. And I would assume that I would not step right into the Muppet movie. I know, but I think I was being auditioned for the Muppet movie. And so it was one of those relationships. You know, I brought Kenny Asher in to write the songs for the Muppet movie because I wanted those kind of great melodies that he writes. Elegant, beautiful music. Kenny is genius. We had done the Stars Born together, written most of those together. And it was just a great, you know, we wrote You and Me Against the World together. He was, you know, most of the songs for A Star Is Born, With One More Look at You, Woman on the Moon, Watch Closely Now, almost all the ones that are, you know, except Evergreen, which I wrote with that lady. And so I brought Kenny in, and the best story, and I tell this a lot, the best example of what it was like to work with Jim is I had just bought a house in the Hollywood Hills, and it was barely furnished. But Jim and Jerry Jewell, the screenwriter and writer for the Muppets, and you know, some of the production people, anyway, a gathering of genius, met together to talk about the movie, what it was going to be about. It's a road movie, how the Muppets get together on their way to go to Hollywood. Why are they going to Hollywood? Because they're looking for frogs to become rich and famous. Gotcha. Okay. And walking Jim to his car, talking about the work ahead, I said, you know, Jim, I know how important this is. This is the Muppets' first big screen adventure. And we're not going to surprise you with what, you know, Kenny and I will show you what we're working on along the way. So you can kind of, you know, if we're headed in the wrong direction, you can give us a little navigational nudge. And he said, oh, Paulie, you know, I don't need that. I'll hear him in the studio when we record him. And I was like, are there people that do that? You know, it's like my experience had not been that kind of gentle, sweet. And what I, and you know, it's been, you know, it's been all these years, and at this point I realized that he just, you know what, he trusted his instincts, and he trusted his instincts to allow the people that the creative men and women around him, you know, to have freedom and to really deliver, you know, what, you know, their best, without him looking over their, you know, looking over their shoulder and seeing Jim back there. And he just, so he got, I think he got the best, because, you know, because we had that freedom, but also because we had. We sense that amongst ourselves. So writing for Gonzo, I mean, it's like writing for Gonzo. Gonzo is separate, of course, but that guy behind Gonzo is one of the most brilliant. Dave Golis is one of the most brilliant, wonderful, loving human beings I've ever met in my life. And so when we have the freedom to interact amongst ourselves and feel those energies, we can do the very best, I think, for Jim and for the Muppets in general. And to hear Rich talking about the impact of Life's Like a Movie, Write Your Own Ending, is like, that's a heart payment. That's, you know, that's like, Jesus, that's why we write songs. And none of us, I think, that started out writing songs, we ever thought we were going to get something that dear, excuse the age-old expression, that dear, that sweet, that important, as the news of what we did is a part of somebody's, you know, the own growth as an artist, because it kind of lit the fires for them and gave them faith in them, in themselves.
I want to segue here. I want to kind of go from Phantom into, I was going to go into the recovery stuff, but I actually want to go into music since we're on the topic. And I'm so impressed at how dedicated you are, Paul, to helping other people. You had such a good experience with, you know, I mean, maybe you got screwed here and there, but it seemed like you, have dedicated yourself to making sure artists are being taken care of, especially musicians. So we have Steven here, who I brought in. Steven's a musician I've known for years. One of the loveliest people I know. And he went to see your keynote speak at ASCAP, and he was so excited that I wanted him to be the one to come ask to just get into ASCAP a little bit. So Steven, are you ready for that?
Yeah, sure. I'm ready. Yeah. Hi, Paul. It's really really fun to meet you in this high-tech
future. It's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you, man.
just curious, you've been president and chairman of the board at ASCAP for about 15 years, quite a long time. Why ASCAP in particular? What's motivated you to stay with it so long?
Well, there's this guy over here on the screen named John Tita who is like, John, unmute yourself. I'd love to have you in this conversation. Would you unmute, John? Would you?
I think I am.
Yeah.
I think I am.
You are unmuted at this point. Thank you. It's like, you know what? We are the only non-for-profit performing rights organization in this country. Wow. Now, there was a time when there were two of us, but it's just us now. We're an organization that is what we used to call in this country a democracy. Mm-hmm. It is of, by, and for the music creators that are the members. That the board is made up of professional working publishers, songwriters, composers, lyricists, and the staff that has maintained for 110 years this amazing organization. Not the same guys. It's been, you know, there have been others before us.
Although I feel 110 every once in a while, but go ahead, Paul.
Well, there have been three before us, I think. But but the fact is that I don't know where I go in the world to find people that will work harder and longer and with greater passion to try to improve the lives of not only the membership, the music creators, but the people that use the music. I mean, the fact is that it's an amazing deal. You can have the entire history of music at ASCAP, everything that we represent by the most amazing artists. And I'm going to let John talk a little bit about that for what amounts to the cost of an adult beverage every day. I don't know what they cost anymore. It's been almost 34 years. So I'm not sure about the price of getting nailed these days. But the fact is, that for the people that use the music, for the people that enjoy the music, part of the reason that it's available is because the attention is paid to the economics. But also, I'd like John to just address for a little bit about the fact that he brings people up through this, you know, that, I mean, that you started, for example, with Billie Eilish when she was very young, I believe, you know, and it's like, so jump in here and just talk a little bit about, so, I mean, I'm the hood ornament. I'm about about going to Washington D.C. and talking to both sides of the aisle about, you know, you've got to improve the rules we operate under so that songwriters can put gas in the car and take their kids to school, put food on the table, but the work on the life and the creativity and the life is you're talking about the head of membership at ASCAP right here is John Tita.
Well, first thing I have to say about Paul, in this divided country, I have walked the aisles and the halls in Washington with Paul. There's only one person I know on earth that can unite everyone. You would be surprised, the people from both sides of the aisle. There's one thing they all agree on. They all love Paul. They all respect Paul. And they're all huge fans of Paul. I've seen it. It's amazing. Having Paul at the helm of the company, yeah, we not only have the great catalogs of George Gershwin and all those great American songbook people, but we have Paul McCartney and Billy Joel and Stevie Wonder, and we've developed careers for people, as Paul was saying, like Billie Eilish and Meghan Trainor. We now have a girl, Olivia Rodrigo. So, and you should see Paul communicate with them all, and they're all in awe of him, and I'm blessed to be working with Paul.
What we have in common, incidentally, is that one of the great things that is no secret is that we don't give up our fan cards to work in music. I don't think any of us that make music. I mean, we just had our ASCAP Grammy thing, and I had never met Lenny Kravitz before. I mean, I love Lenny Kravitz, but I had never met Lenny Kravitz before. And I'm standing there, you know, being, you know, presidential and talking to people and loving my life at all. And I turn around and there's Lenny. And thankfully, I will say we both had the same reaction, but I turned into just like, I was 13 years old. I was like, oh my. You know, it's just, and incidentally, at 83, you know, when I first met Billie Eilish and her brother, I was the same way with them. And they're like children, but they're brilliant, you know. So it's like, and you know, the fact that, that I have pictures with John and I, you know, with the, some amazing, amazing talents that that are American, like American traditions, you know, like Tony. And
Tony, like Berry Gordy.
Yeah, Berry Gordy. And yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing. Anyway, so the support at every level that young songwriters coming on or major names, you know, that are brought into, you know, are attracted by what he does, you know, by what Beth Matthews, who's the CEO of ASCAP, what she manages to do. And it's you know, what I get to do is way above my, you know, my personal capabilities of doing it, but I follow my heart on a daily basis, and somehow I think that I do a pretty good job, and happily I keep getting reelected, and I love the work, you know, and I'd love to do it for a bunch more years. If I can find the men's room, they'll let me.
I just want to throw one more question to Steve, and then we're going to segue a little bit, if it's okay. We're going to leave some time for people to ask questions towards the end, but Steven, do you have one more thing you want to put in? Then we'll switch to Suki and Tilly to bring them in real quick.
Sure.
Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate your input there. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me here tonight.
Yeah, of course. I was glad to have you.
I'm really happy to finally meet John as well. We've chatted a tiny bit on Instagram. Thank you both for your work with ASCAP as a member. It really, you know, means a lot to us.
Thank you.
If I could switch to something else I'm curious about, and you're one of the many, many songwriters, Paul, who's talked about receiving from a higher power when you write. And I wondered if you might want to talk a little bit about that. I'm curious how much is I think you've described it as the big amigo, and how much of it is you, the craftsperson, putting it together?
The fact is that the way that I operate, you know, I used to describe one way, and it continues completely surrendered to that way, and I describe it in another. I'll tell you exactly what I'm talking about. For years, I have been, you know, lucky enough to get. Instantly, let me turn a little more light on here. I just realized that it's starting to get dark here, and I know, you know, if that's too much light, I'll get an umbrella and we'll relight the room. I was one of those people that would always, you know, okay, I'm going to write this song for a film, for a song for Thunderbolt and Lightfoot or something. And I look at the script like that, and then I don't know why, but I put it off and I put it off, and I was like, yeah, oh, but Jesus, that, oh my God, it's been 3 weeks, you know. And I finally sit down, and it pours out of me. And I always talked about this procrastination was a part of my writing process, but then it changed when I got sober. The main thing is when I got sober, I surrendered to and we talk about a higher power of, you know, a god of our understanding. I don't have a god of our understanding. I have a big amigo. I have a consciousness of a general, this, and it's not a guy with a white beard. It's this amazing, you know, organized kindness, and it's available to all of us. And I think that in the church that I belong to, we believe that what we dwell on, we create. That thoughts become things in the church of religious science and or science of mind, not Scientology, but science of mind. And the fact is that when I got sober, which was an amazing gift, because I was 49, I didn't have the best childhood, but I had the longest. I had been, you know, the career I thought I had been probably been gone 10 years, and I didn't know it. And when I did get sober, you know, I found this freedom. First of all, I found community. I found that, you know, and I. I mean, the way I got sober was incidentally in a blackout. I called a doctor and I said I wanted to go to treatment. Called me back the next day and I said, you know what? Somebody else was using my body because I don't know. I didn't call anybody. So yeah, doctor said, yeah, you told me that you wanted to go to treatment. You wanted to, you didn't want to drive drunk with your kids in the car anymore, like your dad did. You didn't want to have to lie all the time, like you were about being sober, because you weren't. And somehow I heard it. I found out 10 years later that the week before I, in that blackout, I made that call. The week before, I had a full tilt psychotic meltdown in Oklahoma City and could not do the show I was hired to do. Did it the next day, flew back to LA, and the guy that promoted the gig was a member of the organization. I do not mention that in public. That way you can find him at the front of the phone book, but I don't mention their name. That's one of our traditions. But this guy, when I met him, and I was 10 years sober, he walked up to me and he said, I just wanted to introduce myself. I booked you 10 years ago. And I went, oh my God, were you the guy when I did my Linda Blair and The Exorcist, lick me, you know, my head spinning. He said, yeah, that was me. I was beaten up for 40 minutes by a monster nobody could see but me. Nuts. Cocaine and alcohol. Nuts. And he said, well, I just wanted to say hi. He was the guy. And I said, well, I'm 10 years sober. I just spoke at the jail and I'm a certified drug and alcohol counselor and Polly this and Polly blah, blah, Polly this, Polly that. And he said, yeah, I heard in the rooms that you got sober. The rooms is he's talking about that organization. And I went, oh my God, are you a friend of Bill? And he reached in his pocket and he brought out a chip for 17 years. Huh. And I went, oh my God, you were 7 years sober when that happened. And he said, yeah. I said, what'd you think? He said, oh, I thought you were dying. I said, yeah, I was bad. I said, what'd you do? He said, well, I called my sponsor. I said, of course you did. You know, you've got some insane little ass who's, you know, out of his mind, you know, and about to die. That's exactly what you need to do. What'd your sponsor do? He said, he hung up on me. And I said, he didn't tell you? He hung up on me. We knew what to do. And I said, what did you do? He said, we all started making phone calls and we put together a prayer circle. This always touches me. We put together a prayer circle of alcoholics in Oklahoma City, and we prayed that you would get sober in or out of the rooms. And less than a week later, in a blackout, I called a doctor. And at that moment, my relationship to that big amigo, that higher power, and the power of prayer became indelible in my life. And all of a sudden, I was relieved of something that I mean, I thought I had worked for. I didn't work for anything. That was an absolute gift. And the big amigo, do I understand him? No, but I don't understand how electricity works either, but I use it. I flip a switch, and prayer is flipping a switch. And my attitude and my expectation of kindness and positive thought about what's going on around me leads me to people like John Tito, leads me to people like Rich, leads me to people like Frank and to Gigi, you know, and to all of you, you know. And so, Perry, that's Stephen, that's, you know, I can include you in that now and all. So what happened to get to the point of how I write is just as I surrendered, I said, you know what, I am powerless over alcohol. I do the same thing. The first job I got was, thank you, Brian Henson. Brian Henson called and said, we're doing the Muppet Christmas Carol and we'd like you to write the songs. And so I said, yes. The phone was not ringing and nobody wanted me in their studio because I had a reputation as an addict. That's why it's amazing where my life has been for the last 15 years, is that I was trusted to this day. But what happened in 1992 is I was all of a sudden tasked with writing these songs. And what I did was the very first song, and here's how it happened. I read the book. You know, I read I read the Charles Dickens book. I read the script. I knew what the songs were going to be about, needed to be about. I knew the first song was about Scrooge. It started with a shot of his front door. It opened, and we saw his feet as he walked through the mud, and as he walked by little characters, they got seemed to get colder. You know, so I took a Lawrence Block novel. I love a good bloody mystery. And I had my tape recorder and some paper and pencil. And I walked out into a park in Brentwood, California, near where my girlfriend lived at the time. I sat down in the park and I said, Big Amigo, Muse, whoever you people are with the great ideas up there, you know what we're supposed to write? Let me know when you have an idea. And I started reading one of the Lawrence Block novel. About three pages in, I put the book down and I went, okay. We see his feet and he's walking. Boom, 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 boom. He's walking through the mud. When a cold wind blows, it chills you to the bone. But there's nothing in nature that freezes your heart like years of being alone. Jesus, you guys, that's pretty good. It paints you with indifference like a lady paints with rouge. And the hated and cursed, the worst of the worst, the most hated and cursed is the one that we call Scrooge. Oh, there goes Mr. Humbug. There goes Mr. Grimm. If they gave a prize for being mean, the winner would be him. I got up to there. It came out of me without a breath in between any of the lines. And I had it on tape. And I realized that it was that amazing surrender, that creative surrender to whatever it's supposed to be, let me know and all. There was a wonderful composer that was on the board for all years on ASCAP named Richard Bellis. And when I told him that story, he said, you thought you were percolating. You weren't. You know, you were procrastinating. You weren't. You were percolating, Paul. He said, so you're percolating. And then you added that mindset that just expects the best. I have a guy that I work with who's a wonderful songwriter named Wes Hamill. And Wes refers to, he does the Native American practice and sweat lodges and all those traditions. And he calls it being a good hollow bone. Just get out of the way, be a good hollow bone and bring the best of whatever you can to the world around you and whatever your task is.
I just want to, Paul, can I cut in for a second?
Yeah, it's your show.
All right, so this is a good segue for why Tilly and Suki are here. Now, Tilly, if you remember, Paul, when we did the Muppet Weekend, I guess 2 years ago, Tilly was the one who made the story that was about the Muppets in recovery. And you were very kind to Tilly to comment. And then Suki, when I read her book, the one that you were graciously put up before, it was so clear that there was like, that book was so musical. I felt like the music was almost a character. And so I brought both ladies in today to kind of get into, you know, you're talking about already, the healing nature of how music helps you in recovery or works with recovery. So I'm just gonna let you both ladies kind of start and then we'll do about 10 minutes of that. And then we're just gonna open it up to other people for questions. And we'll try to keep them to 2 or 3 minutes and bring as many people as we can. And then we'll call it a day. So Tilly, Suki, what do you got?
Hey, Paul, it's nice Hi, to meet Tilly. You.
Hello.
You, speaking of sitting down and just letting your higher power flow through you while you write, that is exactly what happened to me when I wrote what I shared with Rich, which is why I'm sitting here right now. And it is really special. And I got kind of emotional when you were talking about that, because, like, you know, you're talking about Big Amigo and people call it God or whatever. And this right now is how my version of that shows itself. So I'm really, really grateful for everybody here. And I wanted to say thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Are you kidding? It's, you know, it's a powerful emotion and it's a freedom, Tilly. It's a freedom, you know, because you know, we don't run out of ideas. We don't run out of ideas once we accept the fact that, you know, that the constant change and we, you know, we don't run out of ideas when we embrace the idea that it doesn't all come from within us. It comes from within, but what passes through is like every now and then I write something like, oh boy, Harry, that's about Harry Nilsson. Harry, that sounds like you. You know, and I mean, if I knew for sure, I would put all those names on it. But it's just, it's that whoever is that came before, kind of an energy. And I think that it's the parts of us that are broken, Tilly, that allow in the, you know, the things that we dare to say that people normally don't say in a conversation, maybe. And they hear it in a song and they go, wow, yeah, that's how I feel, you know. So thanks for the bruises, because they become ink on the sheet music.
I do have a Muppets tattoo also. It just says the Lovers, the Dreamers, and me. And were you spiritual pre-sobriety?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when I was 13 years old, when my dad was killed in a car wreck, and I was shipped off to live with an aunt and uncle. But those first 13 years, where I went to 9 schools by the time I was in the 9th grade. I was always the new kid in town, and one of the things that when I made new friends, they'd take me to their church, and I found that I got a lot of attention when I was saved. You know, anybody want to come down and give themselves to Jesus? Well, I was always good. It didn't matter the church, you know, I was down, because the people would go, "Oh my God, isn't he darling? Isn't that?" Oh my God, he's giving himself to the Lord, and it's like it was my first theater. So there was that, and that was as shallow as I can be sometimes, but I was loving the attention. Probably had something to do with I wanted to be an actor, which is what I always wanted to do beyond and making music. But I have to tell you that you know, I think as a child of the 60s, I think that I you know, I always had a sense that there was more. And there were times when I felt like I saw things that, you know, that were like, you know, and I don't know if it was flashback or if it wasn't, but there were a couple of situations where I absolutely saw a ghost, you know. And I've always felt, you know, I've always been a seeker about that. There are two books that were really important to me at key points in my life. Right before I got sober, actually, I read the books, but before that, I watched a television special on The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell, and God, I'm trying to remember the
Bill
name
Moyer.
Of the,
Bill Moyer.
Yeah, exactly, Moyer. And there was something about that hero's journey that I was able to, my ego could use that as I embraced sobriety and that new life. And in early sobriety, I was led to the writings of a man named Emmett Fox, and he talks about the power of prayer. He talks about the power of, you know, of the mind, and when you, you know, if, you know, and literally, you know, like back in the 70s, 20 years before I got sober, I would turn to my manager and go, "Do you feel it?" And he'd go, "What?" I go, "Something great is coming. Do you feel it?" And I would almost manufacture that myself, but toward the point that I felt it, I could feel something great coming. And he would go, "I don't feel it. I don't know." But you watch, knowing you feel it, because what would happen is almost immediately the phone would ring the next day or the next couple of days, and it'd be something fabulous. So I think we're powerful. I think that when our thoughts are that positive, and when they are empowered. The first prayer I ever wrote was this: "I am surrounded." It has an important line in it that it expresses my philosophy. "I'm surrounded by the pure white light of our divine creator. I'm surrounded by the pure white light of our divine creator. Only love, gentleness, and goodness will come to me and pass through me to others. This is my prayer. It has been heard and answered." And I think that will pass through me is the most important part of the prayer, because it's not me trying to retain anything. It's me acknowledging that there is this white light, that this energy that is of goodness that surrounds me and keeps me safe, and that I recognize, and that all that's coming to me will pass through me to others is the generosity that we've been talking about, Rich, you know.
I want to shift to Suki, because I feel like you've read her book, Paul. I read her book. It blew me away. And there's a hero's journey in that story, a heroine's journey. So I'm just curious, Suki, do you have anything to talk to Paul about or ask about Paul? in terms of your experience with how writing kind of helped with your own recovery?
I have all kinds of questions for Paul. First of all, I got to say, I love that you were born in Omaha also.
Yay, Suki.
Yes, we are both Omahaans. Yeah. And I just love that. And it's so special to be able to talk with you because your music has been such an important, music is so important to me. Just, I mean, it's interwoven in my life. And my happiest memories with my father were music related, and he was such a fan of yours. And so I don't think it's any coincidence at all that, you know, like that there is some like divine higher power at work that has brought us to this point where I get to have a conversation with you and talk about your music and recovery and all kinds of things.
And I can learn from your experiences and find myself in your book and in your writing and in your courage, you know, and in the gift that you acknowledge.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I am so curious. The first time I ever saw Phantom of the Paradise, I was loaded, completely loaded at a midnight movie. And when I've watched it throughout the years, and I just rewatched it recently, I see this struggle like that is similar to the battle that you have like within yourself during addiction, during alcoholism. How did that play out for you when you were writing that music? And were you at all concerned about the creative process getting sober?
Ask me that last line again about while I was getting sober, because I missed part of that and I don't want to miss anything.
So I think like for me, like when I was thinking about getting sober, I was really worried that like it would just cut off my creativity. Like, did you have any thoughts like that? Like, oh, I'm going to stop drinking and, you know, snorting coke or whatever. And like the creativity is going to be gone. Or were you just like, was that not a question for you?
It was not a question for me because to me, my one task was calling the dealer, and it's like 2 a.m. and she's not answering. And I'm calling the dealer and then she's not answering. And I'm like, God, you know, and I'm angry and I'm loaded and I've run out of what I need. And then she answers, hello. And I go, hi, anything happening? Well, of course, baby, you want me to come over? And you know, that would be nice. Thank you. And I feel fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing has changed yet in the substances that are gone or the alcohol that I'm drinking, but I am fine. I even look better. You little stud muffin, look at you. You're 187, but you know, you are a stud muffin. And I'm kind of, and as soon as I start using the crap again, it's all falling apart because this crap's no good. Where can we get some more and whatever like that and all. So my life is I am a slave to the addiction, to the substance and to hiding it, you know. And I have those highs where I'm writing brilliant stuff, but there's no heart in it. There's no people in it. When I write, I Won't Last a Day Without You with Roger Nichols, I'm writing something that other people feel. What I'm writing when I am as brilliant as E.E. Cummings, and I'll show you, you know. No, nobody's relating. So that has drifted away for me, you know. And when I got sober, all I wanted was to be around recovery. And the desire I wasn't afraid to write. I wasn't without ideas. I just had no passion. And people would say, are you writing? And I'd say, you know what, no. If I fall in love with it again, I will. But, you know, and the gift for me came as a no. When I returned to writing, what happened is I was cast in a movie called The Frighteners, shooting in New Zealand. So excited, you know, and it's like, this is it. This is going to bring me back. And then I get a phone call. You know what? We got John Astin, the actor that we wanted, the movie he was going to do fell through. So, and the minute that I lost that job, instead of going, you know, I did what I believed, it, you know, and had I actually believed before I got sober. oh, wow, what's coming? Something, there's something better. And the next day I got a phone call from the people in at the NSAI in Nashville, and they said, we want to honor you. Come, we have a thing called Tin Pan South. Would you come? And I said, sure. Are you kidding? A plaque involved? Absolutely. And I went there and I got that kind of, I can do that too. You know, when my little brother was like 5 years old and I was like, I'm 6 years older than him. So I was like even younger when he was probably four and I was 10. And I'd sing, my dad would get me up and have me sing for the neighbors, you know, or on a Sunday, sing for the neighbors. And I'd be singing, I'm yours or whatever, Danny Boy or whatever. After I'd sung and gotten applause from the audience, you'd hear my little brother would be behind a kitchen door and he'd go, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very, no matter what time of year it was, had a very shiny nose. And then he'd stick his head out and go, I can sing too. And he'd storm off in the other room. You know, so that's kind of what I felt in Nashville. And I met a songwriter named John Vesner, who I love John Vesner's stuff. I'd never met him. But I went to his place for the first time I was ever going to sit down and write with another human being, collaborate. It was just terrifying, you know. So I go to John, very quickly, I go to John Vesner's place. He's got a beautiful carved door with one of those little windows in it. I ring the doorbell. He comes to the door. He opens the little window. There's nobody there. So he leaves. And I go, come back. And he opens up the door because I'm so short. I was under there. And I think he was screwing with me. But we sat down and we started talking about recovery. And we wrote a song called You're Gone, which was, wait a minute. No, you can't go away. Yeah, I'm getting a phone call that goes directly to my hearing aids. So, I lost you guys for a second. Hang on. Let me get Zoom back up because I just lost you. There you are. So anyway, I go in and we write this song, You're Gone. And it's about recovery. And when I walked in and he's this big guy with a full black beard and he's from Minnesota. So he only smiles when he has to, you know, and I'm going, oh Jesus, this is a bad idea. And I'm scared to death. And I said, can I use your bathroom? Because I pray before I write. I pray all the time. But it's a very friendly conversation. And I go into his bathroom to pray. And I happen to be in the bathroom. And I bend down to one knee. And I notice reflected over the mirror in the basin is the Serenity Prayer backwards. But I recognize it. And I go running out. And I'm going, the Serenity Prayer, are you? And he goes, oh, yeah. And I went like, well, I'm. And he said, oh, I know. And he said, I'm like, Mommy, pick me up. Love me. I am home. And I am safe. And all of a sudden, song emerges. And it emerges because I'm talking to another human being that has experienced the same things that I have. And we share. And it goes back and forth. I mean, I could imagine, Susie, if you and I sat down together, that it would be that same kind of a magical moment and all. So I was back. So it was people that brought me back. It's shoe leather. It's God. It's surrender. But it's shoe leather. It's your story and me listening to your story.
Do you have one more quick one, Suki? Then I want to move on if it's okay.
I think that's pretty much it, except that I want to go to the home group that you go to. But yeah, that's
me too.
That's yeah.
we will talk. We're friends already.
Yeah.
So we're gonna kind of do questions. I want to start though with, because this is the 13th year of the page, so it's the bar mitzvah anniversary, and I want to point out Eddie is here. Eddie, can you say hi for a second? So Eddie performed in my bar mitzvah in 1983, and I've known him since. And I just wanted you to meet Eddie real quick, because he's got some stories. He's been a working class musician for years and years and years. And I just wanted to introduce you. Do you have any question for Paul? I don't mean to put you in the spot, but I figured I'd start with you if you have any questions.
Paul, first of all, I'm an admirer, and you're a genius, and it's really great to know you, to meet you. So it's an honor.
Thank you, Eddie. And you look familiar. Have we ever met before?
I played your bar mitzvah, I think.
Maybe so. No, I swear to God, you do look familiar.
Well, it could be. I mean, I'm playing blue stuff now all around the place. So, or you could have seen me on the internet or something like that. So I'm writing.
He was on our podcast, and maybe it was that. Who knows?
Yeah. But I'm writing blue stuff now with four chords kind of stuff, you know, and simple blues. And trying, you know, I'd always go by that Ray Charles quote, simplicity is genius, you know.
Yeah. So
the stuff you've written for even what the Carpenters of Three Dog Night, that stuff to me was what I grew up on. It's wonderful, you know, appreciate it.
So I can't really see. Oh, sorry, Paul. I wanted to open up. I can't see everybody, so I just want us to kind of move. Basically, one person asks a question. If we can kind of keep it in about 3 minutes in there, and then we'll just as many people.
Gene Beretta. I can see everybody. Gene Beretta has a question.
Nice to meet you. I thought this might warm your heart a little bit. Have you ever heard of the Mahoning Drive-In? Above Allentown, Pennsylvania, and it's the last drive-in in the maybe the world, but it's the country that still shows 35 millimeter film.
Wow. And
it's a great celebration every weekend with themes and costumes and the whole deal. And I saw the Phantom of the Paradise on that screen in 2019. They brought it in and showed it, which was really special. And I helped coordinate Muppets Weekend there. We did it last year for the first time, and we're going to do it again. But last year during intermission, it was a sold out drive-in, and about half the people came to the side stage, and we had a sing along of Rainbow Connection, which I'm sure you would have loved to have heard. But just wanted to tell you that because it was a really great moment.
What I call a heart payment. You know, Peter hears me say that all the time. I got a heart payment today. I heard a story that, you know, there's no greater compliment. There's no greater compliment than to find it. Or you know, so I love that. Thank you. And I love drive-ins. You know, when I was in high school, they'd put me in the trunk. So they would have to pay for me. I fit in the trunk of a Volkswagen.
Right. This is a great place. If you're ever, I don't know where you live, but it's above Allentown, Pennsylvania. And they're open from April to Halloween. Every year.
Great. If I roll through town, I'll make a point of checking it out. Thank you. I'm on the West Coast now, but I'm in New York a bunch and traveling a lot, most of it for ASCAP.
Cool. Thank you.
Anybody else have a question?
Yeah. Another question?
Heather.
Heather, yeah. Hey,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. So I've been rediscovering how much I love Paul's music lately because I babysit my friend Etta, who is 7, and she is a big Paul Williams fan. So Paul, if you could join us at our next record party, what are some songs or records that you think a 7-year-old who loves you would enjoy hearing?
A 7-year-old who loves me. Well, you know, I have a granddaughter that is amazing, that is just... that is about 3 and making up Ruin songs already. So, you know, I think that the lyrics begin to mean more at a later age. And also, every now and then I get asked a question that I have no real answer for and everything, you know. She might like the original Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. They were my favorite group, you know, when I was a kid. So, no, I wasn't.
But we'll give that a try.
It's great you're sharing music with the kids. And also, you know what? I did Gustavo Santaolalla and I wrote the title song for a series called Maya and the Three on Netflix. And it's a wonderful series. It's very empowering about little girls becoming powerful and expressing who they are and saving the world in this mythology and all. It's called Maya and the Three. And it's and the title song we wrote is called If It's to Be, It's Up to Me. If It's to Be, It's Up to Me. It's about the power that every little girl has in her future.
Oh, that sounds perfect. Thank you so much.
Got it.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Just kind of speak amongst, you know.
Yeah.
Pillion, you can jump in. Yeah.
Junie. I'm sorry, Junie.
Oh, sorry. Paul, it's like Jeannie, sorry. Are you just you can unmute yourself.
Hi, June.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi. I'm June. Nice to meet you. I don't have a particular question, but throughout this whole conversation, throughout the past hour, I just wanted to say you've inspired me so much and everybody else who's been talking. And I hope to be a musician. I played the trumpet right now, but it's just so exciting hearing everything from everybody's point of views. And yeah, I'm really enjoying listening to all of this. So thank you so much.
Junie's in a punk band. June's in a punk band with her sister and her dad, and it's amazing. I took pictures of them last week, and it was so lovely.
Well, I love the fact that you're playing an instrument at this point and all. But what's even more impressive than that is that you're listening. It took me so many years to learn to really listen, but to be comfortable in this setting, and to feel that you know that maybe kind of this is your tribe. I don't know why. I got a feeling. I do get hunches, and I got a hunch. There's some great music in you to be made. And
thank you.
Believe in yourself. And, you know, and I love that you're taking the time to study. That means that you're learning to read music a little bit. Stay with that and all. And you know, one of the things that I would recommend to you specifically, you know, I don't know if you're writing any words or anything, but if you keep a journal by any chance?
I do. I have so many diaries.
Oh God! Well, you see, somebody's talking to me. Somebody's whispering to us.
Yeah. I
know that what happens is that those things that are meaningful that wind up in your diary, I think that they can be expressed, you know, let them have a life that, you know, that is quietly within that diary, but also let them have the freedom to move you to write lyrics or poetry or books or screenplays. But I would say trust your creative process where you're thinking about it specifically, but recognize that it's liable to emerge anywhere in your life.
Thank you.
I think it'll be really good too.
Wow, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Congratulations.
Talking with you.
Paul, I'm putting you in charge of calling on people if it's okay with you.
Thank you. Not at all. I'm happy to do that. Let me look at page 2 over here and see if I'm missing anybody over here. Liliana.
Hi. So it's really, really amazing to talk to you. This is an awesome event, first off. And I do have a specific question. I just want to say that personally for me, you are one of my favorite musicians of all time. I've been listening to you since I was a little kid. You are my favorite skit on The Muppet Show. That's my favorite episode of it. That's genuinely one of the reasons that I became a puppeteer. So thank you for that. It's going to sound silly, but I was on yearbook committee when I was a kid, and your lyrics, the ending lyrics to The Muppet Show, are the final lyrics or the final words in that yearbook. And I think that's something that it really, really touched me, and it touched a whole bunch of other people in my class. But unrelated to that, I have sort of a weirdly specific question. Do you remember what make and model banjo was played on the original Rainbow Connection recording?
I don't, yeah. But you know what? It was a man named Art Munson, who was my guitarist in my band. He played guitar and he played great banjo. I could actually find out. But one of the things I wanted to ask is, like, how long have you been a puppeteer?
So I'm not that long. I'm only 20. I turned 20 today, actually. Yeah. But I started working with puppets and experimenting with them probably when I was about 5. I'd say maybe earlier. I grew up watching the original Muppet Show. Fraggle Rock is like my passion. That's another huge, huge thing that sparked it for me. And throughout the years, I've been doing, you know, some local talent shows, other stuff, and now I've got some mentors who are, like, trying to help me get into Sesame, and it's really, really amazing. So I guess I guess a while, I guess for technically you could say 15 years, but in terms of like seriously working and practicing towards it, probably the last two or so years.
Can I ask one other question? Where do you live?
San Antonio, Texas.
San Antonio. We just did Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas in Chicago for 6 weeks on stage at the Studebaker Theater there. So, and the great thing about that is it started out as the first thing I did with the Muppets, and it's the last thing I did with the Muppets as well, because we opened on in New York with and got great reviews with some amazing live actors and amazing puppeteers. And then we were closed after like 3 weeks because everybody closed because of COVID. So we reopened this year with, and so there's going to be I'm hoping there's going to be bunches of companies like every Christmas as Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas grows and grows. And I get a chance to watch and the audience gets a chance to watch in person the amazing work of the puppeteers, the Muppeteers and all. So, you know, it would be great to, at some point where Liliana, if you see somewhere, if you can, you know, kind of watch, you know, my Instagram and, you know, and watch Rich's as well, you'll find it if, you know, when we bring it back again, and we should try to get you there. And maybe the prize of this show is to bring you in just to see it and all, if you're still working with puppets and all, but okay. I've said it out loud. We will do that. Well, the prize of the show is
I'll connect you.
Is next Christmas, if Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas is, I'll round trip you into from Texas to Chicago, because we're probably going back into Chicago to see Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas and meet some of the Muppeteers and all the amazing, amazing talents. So happy birthday. There's your birthday present right there.
And if all of you haven't ever seen, I don't know if you've seen them, Paul, if you've never seen the outtakes, if you go into YouTube and the outtakes of Emma Daughter, it is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. Have you watched that, Paul?
Let me have one.
Oh, sorry.
One moment. I just want to hear from Liliana.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Would you be interested in that?
Absolutely. That's amazing. Thank you. I could burst into tears, so I'm not going to, but thank you.
How old are you? 20 today?
20. Yes, sir.
It's your 20th birthday. My wife's birthday was yesterday. So, mm-hmm. You know, so it's in the spirit of both of your Christmases. I mean, both of your birthdays. Let's make it a part of your Christmas as well. So, Rich, get all the information so okay. I can get in touch with Liliana and make sure that she gets it. It gets flown to Chicago if we're there next year. And if it's 2 years, then the deal still applies. But happy birthday, Liliana.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. It's my favorite Christmas movie ever. Thank you.
Oh, that was fantastic.
All right, gotta keep myself from choking up. Thank you. I won't take up any more of your time.
That's very kind of you, Paul. And sorry for stepping in. I just wanted to encourage people to watch the outtakes of Emma Daughter. All right, you're back to you, Paul.
Frank, do you want to jump in for a comment? Are you there, my friend?
Sorry, I was muted because there's construction going on around here, and I didn't want it to disturb anybody.
You can all unmute yourself, FYI, at this point.
Yeah, always unmute yourself, Frank. You've been so generous and all.
Oh, Paul,
you can't turn on your camera so we can see you.
You know, my camera is not working either, so I guess I'm technically challenged today.
I love it.
Well, I'd have to restart the computer, and I don't have the confidence that I'd be able to sign back in.
You know, so, well, we're not going to be going on that much longer anyway, but I thought I'd a chance to just hear a little something from you, because you've always had something interesting, amusing, and there is wisdom there, as there was with Gigi, and you brought it out in him.
You're a dear, sweet man. Well, you know he loved you, and he loved those songs from Phantom so much. And if I had a dime for every time he sang the hell of it on the show. But I had a question before, but it was going to be about a heart payment, and you answered that.
Thank you.
And by the way, it's beautiful. You know, you've shared with me many times that people will stop you in a supermarket and talk about how we've only just begun. You know, was their wedding song or rainy days and Mondays or Evergreen means to them, and you say those are heart payments, and they're in many ways more valuable than any other kind of payment. And that never fails to touch me.
It exactly. Well, that's what, you know, touch. I remember touch is the you know, from the You and Me Against the World for single mothers to touch with Daft Punk, where people talk about you know, that's starting to show up at special occasions as well. And Rainbow Connection, God bless them, people get married to that, and some people in their, you know, in their memorial will request Rainbow Connection. So I'll probably play it in mine, I'm thinking.
But I did want to share something I said to you at breakfast that day. I said, for all the hundreds and hundreds of people who've approached you over your career and your life telling you what your music meant to them, the shame in a way is the thousands, the millions that will never connect with you, that will never get to say that to you.
Yeah, well, that's all right, you know, because what I have been given is beyond. I mean, I love my life. It's a statement that I say again and again and again.
Well, thanks again, too, for the lovey. For those of you that don't know, we did a last memorial show for Gilbert, a live show, and Paul sent a letter that, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house after the note was read. And then we all sang Richard Kine, Craig Bierko, the great John Sebastian from the Love and Spoonful, and myself, and Mario Cantone. We all sang the Rainbow Connection with an audience, and I know Perry saw it. I know Gene saw it. It was a beautiful moment and a special night, and we owe you so much.
Yeah, it was beautiful, and it totally touched me. And I hope to see, you know, I'm coming back to New York on the, I think, next Tuesday, and I'm there till like the 7th. So let's try to have breakfast or something.
Absolutely. On me this time.
Yeah, it's about time.
In Gilbert's honor.
No, it's not. That's
a man who never picked up a check in his life.
I think can we let me take another look around and see if there's somebody else, but if not, just sing out if I can't hear somebody. Just, if somebody has a question, just holler. And Tilly, I'm seeing you wave.
Hi. Before, I'm going to have to head out soon, unfortunately, but I wanted to know, as a somewhat young, sober person working in the music business in LA, do you have any advice for me?
Yeah, stay close. Stay honest. The big thing in music, I think, is authenticity. I will leave you all with a story about my brother that is my favorite story about authenticity. You know, I talk about recovery all the time. I honor our traditions, but I talk about recovery because it is truly the greatest gift I've ever been given. My brother was a songwriter, 6 years younger than me, wanted to be a songwriter like his little big brother. I'm his little big brother. He was my big little brother. He was 6'2". I'm 5'2". So when I went out to Hollywood and started having success, when I was like 30, from 27 to 30 is when I really started hitting it as a songwriter, and doing my time learning to write. But when I was maybe 72, and so I was like 32, my little brother is 6 years younger than me, wanted to take a crack at writing songs. So I got him a 6-month deal, publishing deal at A&M Records. I had an office. He had an office 2 doors down from me. For 6 months, he was listening to the radio and he was writing songs. He was writing good songs, but, you know, he was listening to the radio. He was listening to country, listening to whatever, pop, writing, and nothing was happening. We were on the A&M lot, which is the old Charlie Chaplin movie studio. So it's this big open, you know, parking area with a bunch of buildings around with great and a bunch of sound stages and all. So we went in for 6 months. He's trying to write and nobody's listening to anything all the way through. So at the end of 6 months, on a Saturday, he goes into his office. It's pouring rain. There's nobody on the lot. There's a guard at the gate and men are up in his office looking at the pouring rain outside. And he's totally confused. He's like, what do I have to do? You know, it's like, what do I have to do to make this work? And he's looking at the stuff he's got on the walls and he's got to take it down and get out of there on Monday. And he picks up a yellow pad and a pen and he looks around and he writes down, day after day, I'm more confused. but it's pouring rain outside. So he writes, "Yet I look for a light in the pouring rain." And he's losing this game. So he writes, "You know, that's a game that I hate to lose." But he has a huge faith, even at that age. "I'm counting on you to carry me through." And he writes it down. "Give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away." It pours out of him. He didn't write from listening to the radio. He didn't try to write like his big brother, little big brother. He didn't try to write like the band or Dylan, or he wrote from the center of his chest. He wrote from the loss and the and how much he loved music, you know. "And when my mind is free, you know, a melody can move me." You know, I mean, it's just, it's the greatest story. You know, he passed away in 2016. The last 12 years of his life, he was sober. I've been sober 30, almost 34. So I had 12 years where not only was my brother, he was my brother who loved the reality of life and the gifts that we were given on a daily basis. He would sit and look out the window and go, come here, Polly. Look how the branch comes down and the silhouette of the picket fence, then the mountains behind it, and the bird, the one blackbird sitting on the fence. God is amazing. I mean, look at this. And he had no fear. He talked about the off ramp. You know, my off ramp's coming up, and I don't know when, but, you know, but he had no fear. He died in my arms, and he had three huge dogs. And here's where my faith was ramped up to a whole new level. He had three Australian sheepdogs, the one with the color, different colored eyes. They loved him. He wouldn't fly anywhere. He'd always drive so he could take the dogs with him. But he's lying there in that bed, and the dogs would get up on him, and they'd sit on his head. They'd have three huge animals on him, and he's pushing them off with his cane and giggling and laughing. But the last couple of weeks, I wouldn't let the dogs up on the bed because he had some tubes and stuff that, you know, and he was getting close to the end. And the dogs would, like, nudge his hand on the edge of the bed or lick it, you know, but I wouldn't let him up there because he had to have that peace. And when he passed, I let the alpha dog up on the bed. The dog, you know, Ranger, got up on the bed and just was so happy and was licking Menard's face. And then he stopped and he pulled back and he looked at him and he howled. He just howled. And the other two dogs knew what was that was. And they all three of the dogs began howling. And here's the reason I tell you this story. All of a sudden, as if you flipped a switch, they stopped. And they looked out the side little door where there was a puppy door and where he used to play with them. And they all three ran out that. I mean, tried to go through the puppy door at the same time. Three huge dogs. And they run into each other and they go out there. And outside it's just beginning to get daylight. And they're in a circle. They're jumping up and their tails are wagging and they're barking. And I've never seen them more joyous. And then this, it's like a little tornado of dogs, of fur and barking. And then after about 15 seconds of them, so it was like another switch was thrown and they dropped down on the ground. And they looked around and there was nobody there. He was gone. And they came back in and they laid down by his bed and they grieved for weeks. And finally they came back around and all. I took good care of those dogs because he asked me to. But what I realized is that veil that is between this life and the next life, whatever it is, there is something there that allows us to, for a certain amount of time, have the consciousness to tell the people around us how much we love them. And I made a point at that moment in my life to not wait until I'd stepped through that veil, but to make sure that every day I tell the people I love how much I love them. I love my life. I love the people I hear. It means more than I can tell you to look out there and see my friend John here, because he is my brother. I lost one brother. I got another one. And I love you all. I'm going to say goodbye. And please, please know that this has been a treat for me.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much. I'm filled with such love that I don't have many words. I'm loving you right now. And thank you for how much you've given everybody here and how full of love I am. You're the best. We'll talk soon.
Me too. Talk soon.
Love you, Paul.
Once again, a very special thank you to Paul Williams. He has been kind of the heart of this project for me. There was times that I was ready to quit, that Paul gave me some kind words that really kept me going. And, you know, when you're, Paul's meant so much to me in my world from back in the day as a kid to his work now, and to have somebody of that stature shine a light on you and tell you you're good as well, really has changed my life in terms of this project and putting more energy into it. And please support everything that Paul's involved with. ASCAP, anything you can do, you know, he's done a lot of things. Check out his work, support him in any way you can. He is really one of the most authentic, kind, real people I've ever met. And it's a pleasure to call him a friend and an honor. So thank you.